Now, what time is it?
Well, before you all look at the clock or your watch or your cell phone or your iPad, again, watches are kind of falling out of fashion here these days. There are clocks everywhere on every conceivable gadget and contraption. But when I ask what time is it, I am asking how close we might be to midnight on the prophecy clock. That is the hour when the cry is heard, "Behold, the bridegroom is coming." Christians have wondered and speculated for centuries about the time of Christ's return. And most of us in this room have been watching and praying for this event to occur most of our adult lives, and it has still not come to pass. And yet, as we read in Luke chapter 21, the instructions of Christ are very clear in this regard. Luke 21, verse 34. "But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, with drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly." Now, knowing this crowd as I do, I'm not worried about the first two. Carousing, inappropriate behavior, drunkenness, I'm not going to worry about that. But for all of us, I wonder if this isn't a concern. For it is easy to become weighed down with what? The cares of this life. The cares of this life. Or the stresses of this life. And as we all know, our lives have been weighed down with stressful situations and stressful circumstances. We talked about them today in our announcement portion. We talk about them constantly in our prayer request lists and announcements. There are issues in your personal life. There are issues in the lives of your friends and relatives. There are stress points in our individual lives all over the place. And it's easy to become burdened and weighed down with them. I would dare say that there is no one in this room who hasn't felt the weight and the pressure of the stress points in our day-to-day lives, the cares and concerns of daily living are at times a very heavy burden, similar to that downward gravitational force I was talking about last weekend, and the need for us to be propelled away from that by the power of God's Spirit, a very similar feeling at times, as though you are Atlas carrying the weight of the world on your shoulders. Some of us feel that way sometimes. And yet, we have to, as Christ said here, take heed to ourselves. We have to remind ourselves. We have to be watchful and conscious of the ability of this world's burdens and life in general to distract us and take our attention away from things that are more important. For instance, the day of Christ's return. When the clock does strike midnight, and I refer to the parable of the 10 virgins, and it was at midnight that the cry went out. And midnight is usually the time at which you begin to really saw logs, and you are really out. And as I was mentioning in Stockton this morning, the next verse indicates that the return of Jesus Christ will come like a snare. Other references refer to it as coming like a thief in the night. You know, we take preparations for thieves. We had a break-in in our neighborhood a few weeks ago, and now we're locking our gates and we're checking things to make sure that everything is secure. I have my guard dog ready. I'm thinking about getting a big yellow sign that says, "This home is protected by Wyatt Earp's security service," or whatever. You see these big signs, and you know that undoubtedly there is no such thing as a security system in the house, but the owners of the home have simply purchased this sign or put a decal on their window. I have a security system in the house that I'm renting, but it doesn't work. It's all wired and everything is together. I would imagine that a lot of people have those sitting around because they were really the fad at the time, but usually you have to pay a fee per month, and then they are contacted if something happens, and then the alarm goes off unexpectedly when you open the window or when you close the window, and it's not closed securely. But, you know, you can take all of these precautions. You know, beware of dog. German Shepherd can get to the gate in 2 seconds. How fast can you get there? Stuff like that. All of these precautions can be taken. But I assure you, if you are dead out at 12 midnight and you are startled awake by the breaking of a window in the kitchen, you are going to be startled. You are going to be surprised. It's going to catch you unaware. I've had a few things stolen in my life, thankfully not many, but the thief never called me and reminded me, listen, I'm coming over tonight about, you know, maybe 4 in the morning. Could you have the door open, maybe a few cookies? I'm going to take your computer. And no, it doesn't happen that way. It's always shocking. It's always surprising. It always happens to somebody else, not to you. That's the way Christ's return is going to strike the entirety of the world. It's going to come like a thief in the night. As it says here, like a snare, like a little trap that catches an unsuspecting animal. That's the way it will come upon the world. We don't want it to come upon ourselves like that, and we try to stay alert and awake and aware, but it's not always easy because at times we get burdened and distracted and disoriented, frustrated, discouraged, you name it. The warning clearly is here. Take heed to yourselves. Verse 36, watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, watching is something we've done a lot of. Mr. Armstrong watched events leading up to World War II and came to the conclusion that what? This was probably the final resurrection of the Roman Empire. That the prophecies of the book of Revelation, of Matthew 24, and the Olivet prophecy, all of these events were going to come to pass. That the final resurrection of the Roman Empire was going to be led by Adolf Hitler, and Germany would rise and gather together those final 10 toes of the image of Daniel 2. But of course, as we know, eventually he came to realize, as did many others, that that was not to be the case. And many, many years have passed. What, 70 years since that time? 80 years? It's been a long time, and we are watching and we are waiting. And as we read on Pentecost, in Acts, the first chapter, the angels asked the disciples, why did they stand there gazing up into heaven? Because they were startled. They were shocked. They said, the same Jesus who went up is going to come back down. The eternal question is when. We still have that question. And we want to know. And the times that we are living in speak to the conditions being ripe for the fulfillment of those prophecies that I briefly described here a moment ago, that looked like they might be fulfilled at the beginning of World War II, or as the events leading up to World War II began to come together. And Hitler just wanted a little Lebensraum, living space. And he wanted more than living space. He wanted the world. And he almost got it. But nonetheless, here in 2 Timothy chapter 3, 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. The Apostle Paul was watching. The Apostle Paul, in several references, talks about the end time. It's going to be close. Remember in 1 Thessalonians 4, what did he say? All of us that are alive and remain when Christ returns will be caught up in the air to meet him. Where is Paul now? He's in his grave. Same place David is located, in his grave. They're all awaiting the resurrection. they were not accurate in their estimate of when Christ was going to return. Paul realized that later in his life. Mr. Armstrong realized that later in his life. We may have to come to that same point later in our lives. But we are all praying for thy kingdom to come, even as Christ instructed us. And as we look at Paul's description here of mankind and the human race in the last days, and as we see him refer to those times as perilous, or as my margin in the New King James Version reads, stressful times or times of stress, I want you to listen to these descriptors and see how many of them you can identify as being strong factors in our own culture and our own society here in the United States. And in fact, in most of the Western world. In fact, in a global sense, many of these characteristics stand out and are absolutely true in the 21st century, even as Paul was speculating their truth and veracity and presence and existence in the first century. But how much worse are these conditions? And how have they been multiplied to be even more destructive right now than they were in years past? Let's read. But know this, that in the last days, verse 1 of chapter 3, 2 Timothy, perilous or stressful times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves. Selfishness rules. Narcissism. Whatever makes me happy. Lovers of themselves. Lovers of money. Boasters. Proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power, from such people turn away. This is a description of the human race at the end of the age. Moral decadence and decay will be coupled with political and financial upheaval, violent weather, famine, plagues, earthquakes, heavenly signs, the great tribulation. Dramatic times lie ahead. How far ahead? A couple of years? A decade? 2 decades? I don't know. But perilous times are ahead of us. And world conditions are worsening to the point that I would like to refer to an article that appears in today's Los Angeles Times and read excerpts from it as we introduce the sermon this afternoon. The article is entitled, Stocks Post Their Worst Day of 2012. And that worst day for the stock market of 2012 was yesterday. This article, as I mentioned, appeared in the Los Angeles Times this morning and is written by Andrew Tangle. The stock market is now in correction territory, and investors fear the worst may be yet to come for the global economy. The stock market is now in, investors headed for the exits this week amid fears about Europe's continuing debt woes and concerns about China's economy weakening, both of which are distinct realities, and the signs are already there. But a dismal U.S. jobs report released Friday seemed to push investors to the breaking point. Major U.S. indexes all posted sharp declines of more than 2%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 275 points, almost, just shy of it, or 2.2% of its value. Some $525 billion poured out of U.S. stocks during the last week. I see probably all of our contributions to the stock market wouldn't total that, would they? That's a lot of money, isn't it? I can't even imagine it. That much ran out of stocks last week. The blue chip Dow erased its gains for the entire year. Gone. In 1 week. The S&P was still up, Standard & Poor's 1.6%. Both indexes were on the verge of an official correction, That is a decline of 10% from their recent highs. So both indexes are indicating we are truly in a correction mode. In fact, that was verified by Robert Verdersi, a managing director at Knight Capital Group. We are correcting without a doubt. It's really just chaos on a global scale right now. Chaos on a global scale. And today's economic data out of the U.S. just really put the nail in the coffin. The Labor Department reported that employers added only 69,000 jobs in May, far fewer than the 150,000 jobs economists had predicted. U.S. manufacturing also came in below expectations. The nosedive for U.S. markets followed a rough day in European equities markets. Of the major European markets, the German market, DAX, fared the worst, ending the day down 3.4%. The Dow closed 2.2 down. Germany's DAX closed 3.4. Quite a dramatic drop. There's maximum fear, said Douglas Cote, chief market strategist at ING Investment Management in New York. People are just running for safe, liquid assets. As investors fear a U.S. economic slowdown, Wall Street will still focus heavily on Europe in the coming weeks. And it is unusual to see Wall Street so fixated on the European market, but that's exactly what it is. And can you blame them? Because European bonds are everywhere. Many banks have bought into them, and of course the banking industry is biting its nails, wondering what's going to happen with the huge debt load in Europe, with the threat of Greece dropping out of the EU entirely, embracing its own currency, and will that have a domino effect on other nations who are in trouble economically with their currency, et cetera, et cetera. So it is a very tenuous time in Europe. The author continues. The European Central Bank will meet Wednesday, that's this coming Wednesday, and Greece will hold elections on June 17th. That's 2 weeks from tomorrow. 2 weeks from tomorrow that will determine whether the country follows through with austerity measures required as part of a bailout or if they take a pass and leave the union and reject the restrictive ideas of Germany and strike out on their own, which probably is going to be the preference of most of those in Greece who are really wincing under the economic stress, and it's just beginning. From what I've read, the jury is still out. It's still quite uncertain as to what Greece is going to do, but there are reports that have indicated that the central bank in Europe and other entities in Europe have already laid out plans for the eventual departure of Greece. What will happen if that occurs? It's anybody's guess, and the financial markets are jittery already. We had a bad week based on what happened this past week on the New York Stock Exchange. What lies ahead if Greece bails? It's quite a story. Investors are hoping for coordinated monetary and fiscal efforts by global leaders to boost confidence. Well, you know, world governments and world banks are no more eager to bail Greece and Spain out than the other members of the European community are. It's like paying the bill for your drunken brother-in-law's fiascos. You don't want to do that anymore. You've paid enough. You've given enough. Forget it. I'm not interested in that. And that's basically what Germany is telling the nations of Europe who have been profligate in their spending, much like the United States, somewhat like the state of California, which at varying times, according to our governor, is $12 billion, $15 million, $18 billion, $19 billion in the hole. We're wanting to raise taxes, yet we too have huge commitments to retirement funds for public employees that we simply aren't going to be able to meet. You know what's happening in San Jose right now? Well, let me back up a little bit. In 2001, the citizens of San Jose were bringing cakes and cookies and snacks and desserts to the fire department to honor their firemen. What are they doing now? Harassing them in the restaurant. What are you doing out here eating out on our public tax dollars? You have ruined our economy. Your guaranteed pension plans are why we are in such a difficult strait. In other words, it's not quite the same being a public servant in San Jose in 2012 as it was in 2001, because there are people who are up in arms about the outrageous guarantees that have been made in some cases to pension and retirement plans that simply can never be met under the current financial situations confronting the state of California and other entities, communities, counties, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody's feeling the pinch, and it's going to get worse, and the piper is going to demand payment. The piper will demand payment. You know, you can't ask the piper to do the job without paying. And that old phrase may come into play here very soon. But what have European monetary banks and leaders done to stop the flow of red ink in Europe? Very little. It's like you've got 10, 15 nations in severe financial stress. They're bleeding to death, and one person is walking around with a small box of Band-Aids. And there's nothing else available except small Band-Aids, and the bleeding continues. And I'm afraid the blood loss is going to be so great that there might be loss of life in terms of some of these nations and their ability to stay in the European Union and to even stay afloat. Can you imagine a modern nation going bankrupt and the impact it would have on the global economy? It's not going to be pretty. And we could be in a similar position not too far down the road. In the U.S., congressional gridlock ahead of November's presidential election could prevent any coordinated fiscal strategy to boost the economy. Congress is at a standoff. Attempts have been made for a bipartisan solution to our financial malaise. The president seems to be successful in distancing himself from that and not engaging in the kind of talks that might lead to a cooperative bilateral solution. And, of course, everybody is looking out for themselves in an election year. So our economy continues to falter. We continue to sink in some quarters. The global economy is on shaky legs. As the author concludes his article, we are still in wait mode. There's no real reason to buy stocks other than the fact that they're down. So buy low and sell high. But in this market, is there the stomach for the risk involved? It's quite an article describing not only our national malaise, but also the global malaise that is quickly taking hold and may, in fact, cause a great deal of damage in the short term and in the long term. So, brethren, as I've laid the groundwork here, I'd like to continue to read from several articles that I've collected over the past several months that depict the state of affairs in our nation, in our country. The breathtakingly rapid decline of morals, of our character nationally, of our respect for God and man. I'd like you to listen carefully as our nation's decline is vividly described and portrayed through these news stories written by, in many cases, noted commentators, and editorial columnists who have gained the respect of many in America over the years and who clearly described many of the problems that we are confronting over the past few months. And I've simply collected them here to give a brief thumbnail sketch of some of the challenges we are facing here in the United States. Now, I don't mean to say as I read these articles that any of these is pervasive and all-inclusive and that every member of every community is this way. It's simply a general evaluation of the culture and the nature of our, not just our economy, but our character as a nation. Where are we? What has happened to the United States of America in just one or two generations? And what can we attribute it to? And what does it have to say about the accuracy of prophecy? For as you listen to the words of Scripture that I just read, and we'll read some more after I read through some of these quotes, as you listen to the words of Scripture and listen to these snapshots of American culture, of American life in the 21st century, see the similarities and recognize that we may be closer to midnight than any of us suspect. And again, I don't want it to come upon us as a trap or a snare. I'd like to begin by reading from an article entitled, "This is No Time for Games." It's written by Peggy Noonan. She is a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal as an editorial columnist. This article appeared in the July 16th issue of the Wall Street Journal. That's 2011. And she was discussing the intractable budget battle on Capitol Hill that was in full-blown warfare at that time. It's calmed down now, but it's simply calmed down because Mr. Boehner and others on the Republican side cannot get the attention of the president and others on the Democratic side to work a compromise. And so they are deeply entrenched and embattled. So not much has changed since she wrote this article almost a year ago now, but I want you to catch some of the insightful comments that she makes about our culture and our nation. It's quite telling. "Pretty much everyone over 50 in America feels on some level like a refugee. That's because they were born in one place, the old America, and live now in another. We're like immigrants, whether we literally are or not. We are all like immigrants. One of the reasons America has always celebrated immigrants is a natural shared knowledge that they left behind everything they knew to enter a place that was different. Different language, different ways and manners, different food and habits, a different tempo. This took courage. They missed the old country. There's a line in a Bernard Shaw play entitled Mrs. Warren's Profession that goes like this: I kept myself lonely for you. That is the unspoken sentence of all immigrants toward their children. I made myself long for an old world so you could have a better one. In other words, I came here to America, I sacrificed, I gave my life in unusual circumstances, in a different environment, that people that spoke a different language had different customs. I left my friends and my family. I did all of that for you so you could have a better life. And so it is for parents with children, and so it is for every generation. We try to leave our offspring with a better world and a better country and a better life than we have, don't we? That's our natural tendency. However, everyone over 50 in America today feels a certain cultural longing. They hear the new culture out of the radio, the television, the billboard, the movie, the talk show. It is so violent. It is so sexualized. It is so politicized, so rough. And you know, a lot of us aren't connected with that, and I'm glad we're not. Because we're not Twittering. We're not YouTubed. We are not connected to the latest on radio or television in many respects. We just don't watch those kinds of things because we're older. Look in the mirror. We're older. It has come. We are there. I don't listen to the radio anymore, really. I listen to my iPod, to the songs I like, where I can customize it and I can listen to what I want to listen to. I don't have to listen to what the most popular songs are, or some disc jockey or whatever that plays music that he likes, or the modern music. I don't know much about modern music. I don't know many of the modern performers. Now, what I see when I click on iTunes is enough to frighten me. As far as the album covers, or if I can say that, or the promotional material surrounding some of the musicians, or the titles of their songs, or their albums, or their dress, or their attire, or the weapons that they have slung over their shoulder, or in their holsters, or whatever. So I see it, but I'm not really immersed in it. And none of us are really immersed in the current culture of America. We have withdrawn from it. We are stuck in our time warp, which is, I'm not saying it's good or bad, we're just not there. But some of these individuals that I'm going to convey their thoughts to you, I'm going to read from their works. They are involved in it. They have their finger on the pulse of it. They are sensing what's happening. And it's good for us to hear their perspective. Because unless you're on YouTube, unless you're listening to some of Lady Gaga's most recent music, you may not recognize the kind of culture that she's describing. But it is there and it is real. And the young people in this room know exactly what I'm talking about. It is so violent. It is so sexualized, so politicized, so rough. And I would describe it as coarse, crude, godless, and valueless. Much of it, not all of it. I want to add that disclaimer. When I start to describe these things, when these columnists and authors describe the culture of America, you can't paint a wide brush. It is not all the same. But much of it is this way. And sadly, it is in a downward trajectory, slouching toward Gomorrah, as the former Surgeon General described it in his book, slouching toward Gomorrah. It's a sad commentary on America today. Again, everyone over 50 misses the old America they were born into 50 to 70 years ago. And they fear deep down that this new culture, the one their children live in, isn't going to make it. I have that concern. You know, in my generation and in many of yours, if your parents didn't correct you, the culture could and the culture would. I can remember way back growing up, I probably had a dozen or more adults that knew me on a first-name basis, that had me do jobs for them, that were my coaches or my teachers or my mentors, my friends. And if I got out of line, if I was going to do something a little bit risky, they would tell me. And not it was not only that that directed me as far as the culture was concerned when I was a youth. It was their example of commitment and dedication, of spirituality, of godliness, integrity and honesty, hard work, commitment to their wives, to their children, to their jobs. Hard-working people that set a marvelous example for the younger generation that was surrounding them. I grew up in a town of 1,600 people. You couldn't hide if you were out doing something you shouldn't be doing. The policeman knew your father. You know, everybody knew everybody else. And so it has its good points and its bad points. What I'm trying to convey is this. The culture of the time was somewhat self-correcting. The Simpsons were not on TV. How many of you have ever watched The Simpsons? Okay. Oh, thank you, Joe, for raising your hand. I'm glad. I've watched The Simpsons. The Simpsons is kind of a comic parody on the culture of our times, and it is at times very, how shall I just simply put, it's disgusting at times and revolting. But it does reflect the culture of our times. I grew up with Leave It to Beaver, not The Simpsons. I grew up with June Cleaver, which June would not fit in well in the Simpson household. She just wouldn't. Those of you that have ever watched The Simpsons. It's a different time. It's a different culture. I'm not saying let's put June Cleaver back on television. What I'm saying is we lost the fabric and character that was represented by people like June Cleaver. And even Wally, the older son, and the Beeve. And Opie. And Sheriff Taylor. Now, those would not make it. They couldn't stack up to Friends and The Office and the reality shows and paternity tests and let's reveal the results on stage and let's see if we can't get a brawl going. Of course, none of you have ever watched those kinds of reality shows, I'm sure. I hope not. But just to be safe, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands. So that's where we are. Do you miss what we used to have? And do you fear that its absence is having a deleterious effect on our culture and our society and our children? Many do. Do you feel like a foreigner in your own country? Think about it. And I'm not talking about anything, I'm not talking about ethnically. I am talking about morally, as far as character is concerned. What happened to the old America? Where is it? Where has it gone? Will it ever come back? Let me read another article. This one is entitled, San Franciscans Try to Take Back Their Streets. It's by Heather McDonald. It appeared in the October 2nd edition of the Wall Street Journal, 2010. Stroll down Haight Street these days. Anybody been to Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco? There you go, getting in trouble again, raising your hand. Haight-Ashbury. Stroll down Haight Street these days, and chances are you'll be accosted by aggressive young vagrants. Can you spare some change? Asked Corey, a slender, dark-haired young man from Ventura, California. Dude, do you have any food? His two female companions, Zombie and Eeyore, swig from a bottle of pricey Tayava tea and pass a smoke while lying on a blanket surrounded by a fortress of backpacks, bedrolls, and scrawled signs asking for money. If you've ever walked the streets of San Francisco in certain parts of town, you have seen sights like this. I have. I've been there. And there are other cities that have it, and I'm not picking on San Francisco, but it is the topic of this editorial column. And she is writing from the standpoint of trying to move the community to do something to make the streets and the sidewalks safe. Continuing. Vincent, a fourth traveler, as the Haight Street gutter punks call themselves, stares dully into space. Asked why people should give them money, Corey replies, they got a dollar and I don't. Do you follow that rationale? Why don't you work? We do work, retorts Eeyore. I carry around this heavy backpack. We wake up at 7 a.m. and work all day. It's hard work. She is referring to begging and boozing. These are young people. Asked if they are embarrassed to be begging, Corey says, I'm not begging. I'm just asking for money. I'm not begging. I'm just asking for money. Such strapping hobos, young strapping hobos, excuse me, see themselves as on a mission, though they're hard-pressed to define it. In fact, they are defined by an oversized sense of entitlement. You know, when the immigrants came to Ellis Island in the early part of the 20th century and landed here and couldn't speak the language, they went to work, they built a business, they put down their roots, they learned the language, they learned the customs, all the rest of it. And their children saw that example and they grew up and they kept working. And there used to be a right sense of pride and self-worth and value in working hard and providing for yourself and your family. But the entitlement age is upon us. Listen to this. Listen to one incident that apparently occurred here in the Haight area. Last October, one of those punks sitting on a blanket with dogs spit on a 14-month-old baby when its mother rejected their demand for change. Disgusting. These days, vagrants carry knives and mace. People who ask them to move risk getting jumped. Merchants try to clean up feces and urine left by drunken youth, and they are sometimes harassed and attacked. But try to clean up the streets and make the sidewalk safe, and you are infringing on the rights of the homeless. And that's been the constant battle in the Haight-Ashbury district, according to this editorial columnist. And yet you can see where some of our youth are headed. And it's not a good place. I can't imagine if I had gotten a backpack and a sign, you know, I need food, and I had sat on the street corner of my hometown, I would have been picked up by the scruff of my neck and hauled home, and I would have been surrounded by people who said, look, this is a bad mistake. You can't do this. You go home. Get a job. Here, come and wash cars for me for $1 an hour. Don't do this. It's not the thing to do. And yet, what do? It's our culture. It's our society. It's a sad time. Here's another one. Why not wear pajamas all day by Elizabeth Holmes? This is from Wall Street Journal, January 19th, 2012. Trend-conscious teens look as if they just rolled out of bed. She's speaking about teens coming to school. Wearing layers of loungewear to class at schools across the country. So, Will, have you seen any pajamas in school? Loungewear? You seen? Yeah, okay. So, I've got a witness here. Now, Will, you don't wear your pajamas to school, right? No. Okay, good. But some do. Listen, the trend goes way beyond pajama day at the once or twice a year event that many schools across the country used to hold to raise funds or promote spirit. Sales of activewear to girls ages 13 to 17, including sweatpants and sweatshirts, but not pajama pants, rose 21% last year over the prior year. A wide neck is key, says Jennifer Foyle, chief merchandising officer, because girls are wanting to show their bra straps at 13. And so they come to school in what appears to be pajamas, slippers, and the works. As with a lot of teen behavior, some adults are annoyed. Surprise, surprise. I've been annoyed at teen behavior. So have you, I would assume. In Louisiana, Commissioner Michael Williams is getting national attention for taking a stand. He plans to propose an ordinance outlawing the wearing of pajamas in public. The moral fiber of America is dwindling away. And you know, it is laughable, isn't it? You chuckle at it. So, and you're tempted to say, what is the big deal? So what if young girls wear pajamas to school? Well, think about it. Do you want your 13-year-old daughter wearing her pajamas to school? And think about all of the sexual content on the Internet. Think about everything. Think of Anthony Weiner and his escapades. Think. And it's easy to say, oh, well, that's just overreaction. Why can't a girl just wear her pajamas to school? You know, she's... Well, how do you know how your daughter wears those pajamas? She might look fully covered on the way out the door, but what happens when she gets to school? Anyway, he continues, the moral fiber of America is dwindling away. It's pajamas today. What is it going to be tomorrow? Walking around in your underwear? Well, it's already there on the beach, and it's already there in the mall. It's hard to go to the mall anymore. And, you know, you just keep your eyes focused on the fountain or the JCPenney sign. I would hate to be the father of a daughter trying to find appropriate clothing for a young lady. Is there any such thing? Appropriate clothing for my daughter would be a heavy canvas bag with a hole for her head and her arms. That's it. But that's life. And somehow we have to deal with it. Here's another article. It's by Charles Murray. It's called The New America Divide. This is the title of his book, and he actually wrote a brief article outlining some of his premises for the Wall Street Journal. He writes, people are starting to notice the great divide, that is the divide in America. The Tea Party sees the aloofness in a political elite that thinks it knows best and orders the rest of America to fall in line. The Occupy movement sees it in an economic elite that lives in mansions and flies on private jets. Each is right about an aspect of the problem, but the problem is more pervasive than either political or economic inequality. What we now face is a problem of cultural inequality. When Americans used to brag about the American way of life, a phrase that was still in common use in 1960, they were talking about a civic and a civil culture that swept an extremely large proportion of Americans of all classes into its embrace. It was a culture encompassing shared experiences of daily life and shared assumptions about Central American values involving marriage, honesty, hard work, and religiosity. Where are those today? Where is marriage today? It is near extinction. And you might look around and say, well, my friends are married, and all the people I know are either married or getting married. But my friends, my brethren, if government can redefine the divine institution of marriage, it is no longer marriage. And we have trouble in River City, far greater than a pool hall. And that's where we are headed. Our own president, the first president in this nation's history to openly endorse same-sex marriage. Of course, he wasn't trying to make a political statement. If a word comes out of a politician's mouth, it is a political statement. I wouldn't even trust excuse me or thank you. It's all politics, especially in an election year. That was one of the most disappointing acts of a president that I can remember in recent memory. So disappointing. And here we are on the cusp of our American values going down the tubes. Honesty? Who was on trial for the abuse of campaign funds? He was acquitted on what, all but one count? He said, you know, I did a lot of things wrong, but none of them were illegal. At least we got that much out of it. We're in a terrible state of affairs, a terrible state. We are at risk as a nation. Over the past 50 years, the author continues, that common civic culture has unraveled. We have developed a new upper class with advanced educations, often obtained at elite schools, sharing tastes and preferences that set them apart from mainstream America. At the same time, we have developed a new lower class characterized not by poverty, but by withdrawal from America's core cultural institutions. People like Corey. You know, you have a dollar and I don't. And so, could you give me a dollar? And if I get enough dollars, well, that will give me enough to buy what I, quote, need for today. I won't go into what his needs are. But this sense of entitlement. Why work for a living when I can beg for a living? Is there anything left of what America used to be? We have withdrawn from America's core cultural institutions. And can we ever retrieve them? Is there any coming back? I don't know. It would be wonderful to see our nation turn around and repent, but will that happen? What about the Occupy Wall Street movement? Do they really represent the 99%? That's what they claim. And you and I are apparently a part of that 99%. Have you read about what has gone on in the Bay Area with the Occupy Wall Street movement? Does that represent you? Do they represent you? Well, I hope not. They don't represent me. And I hope you don't want them representing you either in terms of the blatant destruction of private property, their crude and vulgar conduct and behavior. It's disgusting. Is Wall Street a place where excess and greed have flourished? Yes. But is the antidote to break out a ball bat and break private property up into pieces and steal other people's possessions and property? Camp out and force your will on people? I don't know. It doesn't look like they're really representing 99% of America. And if they are, God help us. If that's 99% of America, where are we? As Margaret Thatcher correctly noted, and I will put this in the context of an entitlement society, however, she said, there is only one problem with socialism. I'll say there's only one problem with entitlement. Eventually, you run out of what? Other people's money. And yet, this Robin Hood mentality of robbing from the rich and giving to the poor, if you will, in other words, taxing the rich and give it to the poor. Go over to Greece, go over to Spain, tour Europe, and you'll find out where that eventually leads. And I'm afraid we're headed in the same direction. Here's another article, The Age of Indiscretion by Daniel Henniger. Wall Street Journal, April 26, 2012. You will recognize many of these incidents that he points out. Past some point, it becomes pointless to ask, what were they thinking? That people exist who still ask this question suggests there's hope. Maybe. Carousing Secret Service agents, thought to be an oxymoron in a slovenly time, was one we didn't see coming. Have you all heard about that story? Secret Service agents dismissed for inviting prostitutes into their rooms while they were, quote, off duty on a job designed to protect the president when he arrived. America's finest. Think back to 1963, the assassination of President Kennedy. Think of the Secret Service agents who threw their bodies down on the line of fire. Think of the Secret Service agent who thrust President Reagan, then President Reagan, into the car and took a bullet. Think about those individuals. And then think about flip-flops and T-shirts and margaritas and red light districts. And then picture Secret Service agents conducting themselves like that. What were they thinking? Were they thinking? It's a shame. Continuing. Former New York Congressman Anthony Weiner, from a class of humanity that fell long ago, nonetheless broke new ground by frolicking in ghastly color online with unmet women thousands of miles away. The age of indiscretion. And Mr. Weiner first denied it, then described it as harmless, and then went on to obviously melt down in a puddle, and he's nowhere to be found. His life, I'm sure, has been ruined by this. What was he thinking? The General Services Administration on retreat in Las Vegas. Have you heard about that one? Well, it was a bottomless joke, and it was an outrageous parody on government workers, and they were poking fun at everything and anything and touting the fact that the sappy taxpayers were footing the bill for this big party, and we've got this and we've got that. And it was kind of like a Saturday Night Live atmosphere at the hotel where they poked fun at and mocked the silly taxpayers for funding all of this frivolity. That's it in a nutshell. Well, guess what? Word got out, as it always does. A little bird sings, always. So, children, in the audience, listen, no matter where you are, no matter what you do, your parents are watching. And a little bird will fly in and tell them what is happening. Little birds fly in for adults, too. The General Services Administration staff, five of them, senior GSA officials, were called to account before a congressional hearing. And here are five suits with their hands in the air, swearing, quote unquote, that they're going to tell the truth. How humiliating. Can you imagine what was revealed in that hearing? You approved what? You spent money for what? You were doing what in Las Vegas? As the author describes it, they were standing in front of a congressional committee, their hands raised like characters in The Godfather. That would be hitting bottom for most people. You would be humiliated, embarrassed, and ashamed. But it seems like the age of indiscretion is here. Wondering what they were thinking is a statement, not a question. Because you know they weren't thinking. The better question is, does anyone think anymore that what they are about to do is at least a mistake? That's what discretion is. Ooh, maybe I better think about this before I do it. Nah, just do it. That's why he calls it the age of indiscretion. Yes, people think about what they're going to do, but those who do think about it and look before they leap are a dwindling tribe. Very few left. They're nearing extinction. Let us stipulate that the GSA and Secret Service scandals involve serious issues of mismanagement and possibly malfeasance. These are serious matters. You entrust, if you're the President of the United States, if you're the taxpaying public of the United States, you've entrusted the safety of the President into the hands of Secret Service agents in flip-flops with margaritas and T-shirts and girls in the room. I don't think so. It just doesn't send the right message, does it? Well, nothing happened. The president was still safe. What's the big deal? See, nothing is a big deal. And really, if you can convince the world that nothing is a big deal, then really, nothing is a big deal. Again, tolerance is the highest virtue in our modern culture and society. He writes, "Welcome to the age of indiscretion. Athletes, celebrities, politicians, bureaucrats, reality TV, YouTubers, no doubt co-workers, and now even Secret Service agents, we're all in. The age of indiscretion. Discretion, before its recent death, had many allies. Judgment, common sense, prudence, reticence, and the two better selves, self-control and self-discipline. Indiscretion, of its nature, weak, dropped discipline and control to let the self run free. Narcissism. And boy, has it ever run free. You are apt to say when you see adults in responsible positions acting this way, could we have a little parental supervision, please? Or, as I was told and have been told many times, didn't your mother teach you anything? But all of that is gone, it seems. When you can see people in responsible positions acting in such indiscreet and outrageous fashion, it makes you wonder if there's anything left out there that is questionable at all. Have you heard about the latest flash mobs? A sudden group of people with a single purpose is a flash mob. Groups of teenagers swarm into stores, grab everything they can, and run out. This phenomenon is on the rise across the country, so much so that police have called these incidents flash robs. Flash robs. Because after all, what is security going to do when a large group comes in and suddenly they grab everything they can and run out of the store into the parking lot and disperse? Which one are you going to go after first? It's become such a problem that police have called them flash robs. America's not alone. This is a story out of Britain by Theodore Dalrymple. It's called The Ugly Brutishness of Modern Britain. A few days ago, at a crowded bus stop in the city of Nottingham, an overweight youth of about 13 started to throw food at a friend. Some of it nearly hit me and landed on the ground just behind me, or beyond me, excuse me, making a mess. "Excuse me," I said to the youth, "could you pick that up?" "Shut the blank up," he snarled, and I won't fill in the blank, with real hatred contorting his face. Out of the mouths of babes and sucklings in England come obscenities. No one at the bus stop dared say, much less do, anything. For increasingly, the English are a people who know neither inner nor outer restraint. They turn to aggression, if not to violence, the moment they are thwarted, even in trifles. It is difficult to overstate the deleterious effect on the quality of life in modern Britain of incivility and bad behavior. Practically no behavior is now beyond the pale for the British state. Sadly, the freedom to behave badly is almost the only freedom valued by or left to young Britons. The freedom to behave badly, valued and cherished. And from Italy, one more. January 13th, 2012, the Costa Concordia, the cruise ship from the Carnival Corporation lines, 4,000 people aboard, struck rock and eventually sank off the Italian coast. The ship's 52-year-old captain was arrested and held on charges of manslaughter and abandoning ship after 30 people lost their lives in this disastrous debacle. The captain's reckless conduct, coupled with his refusal to heed the Coast Guard's admonition to return to his ship and oversee the rescue evacuation effort, broke the unwritten law of the sea. The captain stays with his ship. What was his story? Well, he inadvertently stumbled into a lifeboat as it was being let down and then had no choice but to float off. And then he didn't have an explanation as to why he didn't heed the command of the Coast Guard commander telling him to get back on that ship and oversee the evacuation. He refused to do so. 30 people lost their lives. The unwritten law of the sea, the captain stays with the ship. Tragic. And yet, is it symptomatic of our times? Our culture, our future. And let us not forget the international crises that are gripping the entire world, from the European Union to Syria to Afghanistan to Iran and Israel, Egypt, Russia, and a host of others. Are the economic sanctions going to stop the nuclear production in Iran? Is it? I don't think so. Now, it's been sounding like there's some hope, and perhaps our president, who has proclaimed the advantages of negotiating with Islamic terrorists, is now seeing that it doesn't work. It never has worked. And what will be left to the nation of Israel but to bomb those facilities? What if that happened tomorrow, next week? What would that do to the fragile economies of Europe, the United States, Britain, all of our global world, if you will? You think things are shaky now? Why do you think that Los Angeles Times author was commenting on the global picture and how frightening it was and how scary it was? We live in very perilous times. Turn with me to Isaiah, the first chapter, if you will. Isaiah chapter 1. Here we read the prophet addressing the issues relating to the nation of Judah. Actually, the book of Isaiah and his prophecies span four different kings and a space of about 40 years. But I'm suggesting to you that the prophet Isaiah had more in his sights than the nation of Judah and the demise of that nation and the downfall of Jerusalem. He was prophesying to the latter fulfillment of Israel, modern Israel, and the promises made to Ephraim and Manasseh, and the condition and state of affairs that those modern-day Israelitish nations would find themselves in at the close of the age, near midnight. And as we have read a couple of prophecies in the introduction, as we have gone through these articles describing the condition of the United States and to some extent the condition of the world in which you and I live, let's read just a few verses here in the book of Isaiah to get a feel for what the prophet has to say about modern Israel and see if it rings true by comparison to what we have discussed and observed this afternoon. Here in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 2, "Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth. For the Lord has spoken, I have nourished up and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner, the donkey its master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people do not consider." We are quickly becoming a godless society and culture, despite the fact that we are dotted with churches. And we proclaim to be religious and spiritual. But look at our culture. Look at our society. Look at our actions. We are much the same as is described here. You know, God fulfilled His promise to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. The great nation and the great company of nations has come about. But now we are in decline. Look historically at every major empire. Every prosperous nation, where are they? The Roman Empire, the Macedonian Empire, the Babylonian Empire. They all eventually go down. It's just a cyclical thing. Are we on our way down? Have we reached the bottom? Listen to this description again. The ox knows its owner, the donkey its master's crib. The donkey knows where it gets its meal. The ox knows its owner. The ox responds. The donkey responds. But God's people, Israel, don't respond. They don't even know who He is. Your dog comes when you call it. Israel is unresponsive. It was then, it is now. Alas, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a brood of evildoers, children who are corruptors. They have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked to anger the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away backward. Verse 5. The whole head is sick. The whole heart faints. It's compared to a human body. Think of our nation as a human body. The head, our government. We are gridlocked. What is the answer? Well, is it a new president? Is it a new Congress? I drive by a billboard every time I drive to Reading. What does it say? Throw them all out. Or vote them all out, I think it says. Vote them all out. All right, sounds like a great idea. What's the problem? Well, somebody else is going to come in. They're going to be human too. Eventually, we're going to get to the point where we need the return of Jesus Christ in the government of God because we recognize that we as humans cannot govern ourselves. That's what God told Adam and Eve to start with. We have never believed it, and we have implemented government after government, nation after nation, up and down, up and down. And it's going to finally come to the point where Satan's going to give it one last-ditch effort. He's going to create the final world-ruling empire that will confront Jesus Christ at His return, and that great stone cut out without hands will crush that image of Daniel 2 on those toes of iron mixed with clay, and the whole image will come falling down. And that great stone will turn into a mighty nation and kingdom, the kingdom of God. We've all heard that prophecy. We've all heard it explained. But that's where we are now. we are in a situation where the world is quickly going to become aware of the fact that we are spinning out of control, and forces beyond our control are going to take us where we, as a world, do not want to go, but it's like an undeniable force that will pull us in that direction, because Satan is the god of this world, and that's where this world is headed, and that's why we have to work so hard to get out of its gravitational force and field. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. What a sad description. And yet, as we see our nation in decay and in decline, it is nonetheless a reality that we have to face. Your country, verse 7, is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Of course, this refers to the nation of Judah. And when you consider the great tribulation and the other calamitous events that are going to occur that will affect our nation and the world, we're going to see much of this occur. But we're also going to see the restoration and the salvation, just as Judah saw it, just as Israel will see it, so will we see it. And notice that will come as a result of what? Verse 9, unless the Lord of hosts had left us to us a very small remnant, we would have become like Sodom, we would have been made like Gomorrah. There was a remnant in Sodom and Gomorrah. Who was that? It was Lot, Abraham's nephew. He was pulled out at the last minute. Our modern nations, modern Israelitish nations, are referred to as Sodom and Gomorrah. And we are a remnant within. We are the elect. We are part of the elect. Those whom God has called, whose minds have been opened, for the elect's sake, what does the Scripture say? The words of Jesus Christ, these days shall be shortened. If they weren't shortened, no flesh would be saved alive. That's the nature of the times in which we live. It is frightening. And yet the older we get, the easier it is to detach ourselves from the reality of it. And at times, we have to remind ourselves just how bad things really are. And at the same time, how good things are really going to become, as God makes it possible. He goes on to talk about their futile sacrifices and their useless religious exercises. Your new moons and your appointed feasts my soul hates. Verse 14, I am tired of bearing them. I am weary of it. Even though you make many prayers. Verse 15, I will not hear. Then there's a call to repentance. Wash yourselves. Make yourselves clean. And then, again, in verse 21, we read about the degenerate city of Jerusalem and how it's gone downhill. And you read a description of the political morass in which we find ourselves. Your princes, verse 23, are rebellious and companions of thieves. Everyone loves bribes and follows after rewards. They do not defend the fatherless, nor does the cause of the widow come before them. And so God talks about taking vengeance. But then again, he talks about redemption in verse 27 and restoration. And yet, at the same time, he talks about the ultimate destruction of those who refuse to bow the knee and submit themselves to the Eternal. I want you to notice one more verse here in Isaiah chapter 3, verse 12. As for my people, children are their oppressors. Now, you could take that literally, or you could take it figuratively, because the leadership we have is decidedly immature, childish in many ways, selfish, self-serving, just like a selfish child who is unrestrained and not taught better. Or children can rule over us, as they ruled over that gentleman at the bus stop in Britain. Shut the blank up. I don't have to do what you tell me. I'm 13 years old. I've got food I can throw. I don't care what you say. And everybody's silent. Or Corey on the street. You know, I got a buck. Or no, you have a buck and I don't, so give me one. So here we find children oppressing us. Women ruling over us. O my people, those who lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your path. Now, can women lead? Can women be a fine example? Yes. But the opposite can be true as well, with men and women. The point is, our leadership is not up to the task. And really, who is when you consider the spiritual nature of what we are confronting as far as this world and its ways? Well, it's been a frightening snapshot of our nation and its culture, coupled with the current events that are causing even seasoned professionals to have their doubts and concerns about our ability to survive morally, spiritually, financially, politically, nationally, internationally. There are grave concerns, as expressed by many people from many quarters. And as we read, we are to watch and to pray. And I'd like to close by turning to Matthew 24, verse 22. I referred to this earlier. Matthew 24, verse 22. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. How thankful we should be that those days will be shortened and that we are part of God's elect and that one day the whole world will be God's elect, if you will, and will be living in a new world, a new age, a new time. So let us continue to watch and pray and especially support and encourage one another as we see the day and the hour approach.